So I guess part of what I'm here to do is to provide some degree of context for the world in which we're looking at the promiscuity or the structure of systems. So I'm going to start with talking about a project that some friends of mine did, or is kind of ongoing, called the Dark Mountain Project, which takes as its starting point that we are looking at least a dozen catastrophes, any one of which is civilization-ending scale, things from biodiversity loss, ocean acidification, global warming, ocean rise, a large set of different resource choke points, you know, peak oil, peak tin, peak, you know, even peak uranium, but that kind of any one of these catastrophes is enough to completely disrupt and destroy global civilization, and that we will probably solve a few of them, and we will probably dodge a few of them. But if one is honest about the future shape of the world, the other half dozen will get us. And in 100 years-ish, 150, who knows, 50, depends on which thing you're looking at, all of this is gone. So all of the things that we currently see as making up humanity is not really gonna stay around. So the question that the Dark Mountain asks is not how do we survive this or prevent this, it's how do we understand this and continue having some of the things that make us human now and that we care about now. So they choose to work in the domain of myth. So the Dark Mountain Project is a project for coming up with new myths that will let us maintain our humanity through a coming darkness. And you can think it's hyperbolic or not. I think that one can be simultaneously optimistic about our ability to retain a structure of human civilization and also realistic that that structure will shift radically, will shift more radically in this century than it did in the past century. You know, in the past century, probably 95% of the world was subsistence farming in 1900. You know, 90% certainly, and now 5%, 10%. You know, that shift is going to be smaller compared to what we're looking at. If you look at the current estimations, especially with some of like the methane predictions and that kind of thing, it is likely, who here in the room is under 40? So it's likely that in your lifetime you will see 3 or 4 billion people starve to death on our current business as normal projections. You know, and getting away from that will require a really massive shift in the organization of human industrial society. So industrial autocatalysis is the process by which you take a thing out of the ground, you process it, you turn it into energy and the things required to take more things out of the ground, and that loop, you know, and you can kind of think of it most cleanly and like, okay, so what does it take to run an iron mine, you know, and then a steel plant, and then a heavy equipment factory, and then your network spreads out, and you can take any given cycle, but those cycles are where the breakdowns end up magnifying, because if you lose auto-industrial catalysis, you lose all of the things that depend on it, because those dependency chains go both ways. John Michael Greer has a really interesting paper on catalysis and complexity, where he talks about, this is coming from a lot of the kind of limits to growth perspective, but where he talks about every society has a limiting factor to it. And often they don't realize what it was. Like the Roman Empire's limiting factor was unconquered nations that were near enough that they could project imperial power into them. And he talks about the various strategies that societies use to kind of deal with running out of that limiting factor. And so one of them is splitting, is fragmenting, which is, you know, you have the Holy Roman Empire and the Eastern, you know, and what you had in the East was a much smaller and more sustainable version, because it just was going to just get rid of all of the kind of unsustainable Western provinces, including Rome. But the other thing that you get is upshifting to a new resource that's more available, but that necessarily adds complexity, because that was the reason why that resource wasn't being exploited to start with. And if you look at the scope of human history, every time a civilization upshifts to a new resource, the time to run out of that new resource is vastly reduced. So this gets into the, even if we upshift, even if we significantly change, eventually, probably much sooner, we're going to hit that wall, and maybe you shift up again, and at a certain point, you know, at a certain point, the structure fails. So I like to talk about this as the infrastructural century, and I guess in my head, pipelines are kind of a special case in a special category of kind of more general infrastructure. You know, in some ways, the infrastructural century is more than just the 21st century. It's the 20th century as well. But the shift is the point at which infrastructure really becomes globe-spanning. Now, we've had, you know, trans-global trade is at least 5,000 years old, like, for, you know, very precious materials in small quantities. It's been going on for an amazingly long time. But the shift is when you have dependencies, when you have cascading failures that are planetary size. And that's when you have to start working to make infrastructure more visible and more understandable, because all of our lives depend on these incredibly long supply chains. I'm going to jump a little bit. This is a really seminal paper in computer security called Reflections on Trusting Trust. And it talks about, so let's say you want to introduce a backdoor to a login program that so that you can log in with some extra password. And so the first thing you do is you put the backdoor in the code, and then you compile the code and you replace the login program. Now anybody can look at the code and see, oh, there's a backdoor there. So then you put a backdoor in the compiler, and it notices when it's compiling the login code and inserts the backdoor. But then anybody can look at the source code for the compiler and find the backdoor. So then you compile the compiler, and it notices when it's compiling itself as well. And so the backdoor exists in the object code, but not in the binary, or in the binary, but not in the source code. And this understanding, like, this is a generalizable problem. Anytime you have an opaque system, or a system which is partially opaque that has certain behaviors, there is that, how do you trust, how do you understand behavior, how do you understand actual behavior? And in some ways, this goes further. So when you open up an SSL web page, you know, it says the server gives it a certificate, and then it checks it against a list of root certificates. And if it's changed one of those root certificates, great, it's a trusted certificate. Well, how do you get those root certificates? Well, they come with your browser, or they come with your operating system. But how do you trust your operating system? And so maybe you have a key that signs your operating system that's baked into the hardware that you got. And so then you can trust the OS and trust the list of root certificates, but how do you trust the hardware? And at a certain point, you have a, so you can go back to the firmware that it's programmed with. Then you can have backdoors that are purely in silicon, not in the software that ships with the hardware at all. And then at a certain point, you have chip masks. You know, and chip masks are the things that light is projected through to physically make the chips. But how do you understand, you know, how do you trace a specific piece? How do you understand whether or not the chip mask that you looked at and the chip that you got, you know, when it's, you know, a fab is a $7 to $11 billion structure, there's no transparency there. And at a certain point, there's this fundamental failure of trust continuity, which we don't know how to solve yet. We have no real ideas on how to solve yet. Although There are some interesting statistical hacks there and behavioral hacks there. And this is kind of one of the shifts that we're seeing, is a shift from legibility to statistical correctness. And that's very much part of how we can understand these very large scale infrastructures that are too big to really understand.
Can you say something more about what these two?
I'll get to that in a little bit, I think. And if not, I'll come back to it.
Okay.
So pipelines are interesting as a metaphor, because every metaphor that we use to talk, you know, the notion of catalysis implies a certain kind of almost organic structure. The notion of a pipeline implies flow, right? So it implies that there is a thing that is flowing through this pipeline, that all of the things that flow through the pipeline are commensurable, are interchangeable in a certain kind of way. Oh God, what's his name from the Pirate Party? I don't remember. The annoying Swedish loud guy. Some of you may know who I mean. Anyway. No, he's fine. Do you remember the old guy? Falkfinch. Falkfinch. If you don't know who that is, don't worry about it. He's a guy. He occasionally posts interesting things and occasionally posts really dumb things. But one of the things he said is we should not use the word content, because content implies container, and pipeline also implies container. So as soon as you're talking about pipelines, you're talking about structures of control, you're talking about commodification, you're talking about, you know, culture being reduced to transaction, and it's, you know, it's difficult to get away from this while retaining that structure. And you're also talking about legibility, which is something I'll jump back to again in a minute. So one of the things we can see infrastructure, and I include money as an infrastructure, money is very definitely an infrastructure, is as a kind of liquefied agency. You know, that we, you know, sometimes liquefied, sometimes calcified, but it's this, you know, we want to do a thing in the world and we pour energy in and then create this setup that makes things significantly easier and lower friction over time. And pipelines are very much, it's, you know, why do you have a pipeline? You have a pipeline because you think you're gonna need to traverse the pipeline more than once. You know, you think that there's going to be some need for repetitivity there. One of the structures, jumping back to the Dark Mountain, one of the structures, you know, it's not just civilizational collapse in the sense that, well, yes, people will starve, but it's not like they're gonna starve nicely and just sort of stay at home and just sort of quietly starve over there, or over here, or wherever, you know, wherever the kind of poorly distributed impacts are the worst. The DIY bio movement is really, really interesting. It's doing a lot of really fascinating things, but one of the things it's doing is reducing the barrier and, you know, making it easier for people to come up with novel organisms. So one of the big questions in the context of the Dark Mountain is how do we shift society in such a way that the people more impacted by our previous largesse will not want to kill us? Because right now there's, you know, so say you engineer a bioorganism that kills anybody who's eaten meat in the last 6 months. You know, how do you shift that, you know, as agency has become liquefied, how do you tell stories about that agency, or unwind that agency, or equalize that agency? Who here has read Seeing Like a State? Two. Okay, so strong recommendation. So Seeing Like a State is a book about what the vision of states does to the world. And so it starts off, the initial story is about the German scientific forestry program. So the Germans decided at some point in the 1600s, I think, that the point of a forest was to provide revenue for the state. And, yep, there we are. The point of a forest was to provide revenue for the state, and the biggest problem with forests was that they were not providing revenue in an efficient and predictable manner. So they did the sensible thing and clear-cut and planted trees of the same species in rows so they would get predictable yield from an area, and they could thus make that forest legible to the state. And this worked spectacularly for the first growth cycle, and okay for the second growth cycle, and it was a catastrophic failure for the third growth cycle because that exhausted the nutritional capacity of the soil. But of course they didn't see that coming, and these cycles are each 80 years long. So this was now in the 1840s when they had a forestry crisis, and they realized that they had 2.5 centuries of bad policy to unwind. The other really interesting thing, in addition to optimizing the forest for that kind of specific mindset, is that this policy did not, all of the other things that a forest does, a forest is used for, a forest performs, allows, affords, were not part of that vision. So the ritual uses of the forest, foraging, coppicing, firewood, all of these other things, and so this ended up imposing really significant burdens and shifts in how everyone around those forests lived and could live. And they talk about a lot of other examples. Last names are a really interesting structure of state legibility. The Chinese, I think it was in the Warring Kingdoms period. I should have this in my head, but one of the fairly early emperors was the first person in the world, or the first state in the world, to impose last names. And last names were used for two purposes. They were used to ensure that they could inflict punishment on the patriarch of a household for misdeeds of other members of the household, and to ensure that every household provided a body for military service. And so the entire structure of, well, why do families need to be legible, was to serve the needs of the state. And in a lot of cases, money comes in from the same structure. Who here has read Debt, Graeber's book? Again, really, really useful. Debt, the first 5,000 years. When he talks about a history of money as being, first a thing that we used not for trade, because it wasn't trade exactly. If you needed a chicken and I had some nails, we didn't barter. You just gave me a chicken and I gave you some nails because we were part of the same communal unit that shared resources. But money was used for debts that couldn't be repaid through kind of conviviality. So marriages and murders required an exchange, and it was a propitiatory exchange. It was a religious exchange or a spiritual exchange, as much as, it was saying, I know that this thing that has happened cannot be in any human way accounted for, so we're not going to account it, we're going to do this other thing. But then through the slave trade and other things, so that started infecting first slaving and then eventually conscription and taxing, and so, payments in lieu of conscription into an army, and then eventually kind of echoed down into a normal everyday monetary system that was legible to the state kind of all the way down. And now increasingly we see states trying to get rid of cash because it's not legible enough. But really, it's super empowered seeing, because it's not seeing like a state, it's seeing like an entity whose vision is capable of imposing itself on the world. One can see like Google just as much as one can see like the European Union. And in some cases, seeing like Google matters much more and has a much more normativizing effect on society. So I gave a talk at a conference called Future Everything a little while ago, where I talked about magic. And magic ends up being a really useful pool of either metaphorical or actual structures for thinking about, especially technology. Technologists are really, really, really bad about thinking about power in technology. They don't want to see an additional valuation framework. But if you talk about magic, somehow they can suddenly see power again, which is a neat trick.
It's magic.
I talked specifically, so who here is vaguely familiar with chaos magic as a kind of conceptual structure? Few people, okay. So kind of the idea with chaos magic is that you project a will out into the world, you know, and I'm radically hypersimplifying here to get at a kernel, which I think is useful, but, you know, what you are doing and working is not necessarily direct, well, it's unclear, ill-defined, and does not need to be defined if you're directly influencing the world or not, but you in some way sort of concretize your intent and project it out into the world and channel some energy through that intent, and then the world changes in some way. And this can be as simple as like, oh, I want to lose weight, so I'm going to like think about this as I eat, and then, you know, something happens in the world. Or it can be kind of much more occult and mystical, and how it works and where things fall in there doesn't really matter. But so I like to talk about Silicon Valley and kind of the startup culture as a bunch of mages, and they're channeling this collective intent together and producing a magic that works in the world, and they're funneling VC energy through it, and then the world changes. Now, one of the really interesting things about intent is that holding intent for a single person is hard, right? Especially when it's complex. It requires a significant amount of mental energy to kind of turn it into a narrative or whatever and kind of hold this thing in your head. Holding it for a group is much harder. And you get all of this kind of detritus of collective intent. We call them specifications or manuals or, you know, development documents or whatever. Really, that's a collective trying to hold an intent together while they, you know, do some working in the world. Now, it is easiest to hold intent with people who are like you. If you have a group of people who share a rich cultural background and are doing a working for a thing within that cultural background, they have huge amounts of shorthand. They don't have to define all of the things which are shared cultural background because it's just there. The best example that I have of this, so when they built the iPhone 6, when they designed the iPhone 6, what they did was they came up with prototypes in 1/10 of an inch variants, like 30 or 40 of them, kind of across the size range that they thought they were going to want to use. And the whole design team carried them around, you know, working prototypes, carried them around, used them for like a week each, whatever, until they stopped feeling like kind of new things and started feeling like just, you know, a thing that is in your life. And then they picked the ones that fit their hands best. So that's why the iPhone 6 is too big for most women to hold, because the design team is 95% male. Mm-hmm. Because holding that intent in their head of even just, there are people who have different hand sizes than us, was too much in the context of that. Now that's a big, obvious, legible kind of piece of difference that one can simply say, okay, well, we found the scale, but let's understand that this is relative to our hand size, and okay, look up the Dreyfus 95%, you know, hand size curve, okay, find the matching points, done. Great, we now have hand, you know, we now have sizes that will work for a much broader spectrum of the population. But the thing in a big complex working in a big complex system is that there are all of these tiny little decisions. And at some level, you can't simulate all of that intent, or to simulate all of that intent would be incredibly time consuming, because again, you have to look up the chart and remember to do that, and you know, and that step, that loop, which is, you know, the argument for diversity in design teams, but it's also an argument against these kind of super empowered entities, because an entity like that necessarily reflects a unity of intent, a singular position in a social web. And if it doesn't represent a singular position in a social web, then it can't act. There's a really interesting scaling curve that I'll just try to draw real quick. Let's see. An organization. The blue is an institutional structure. Institutions are structures that centralize intent and distribute it very, very well. That's the whole point of a hierarchy, is that kind of each stage transmits intent down to the next stage, and decisions flow up to the, you know, to the point that has a sufficient overview, but therefore necessarily also a sufficient coarseness of insight that they can make that decision. And that means that they get more effective fairly slowly. You know, it's as you add more layers, that's when the institution form comes into itself. Networks become effective very quickly. They're not as good at propagating intent over large networks because there's no kind of strict push of like, this is what we're going to do. But decisions can be made at a very granular level, kind of at the ground, as people who are close to the problems. And so they allow people to kind of force multiply very easily in small groups. But as they get bigger, they eventually decohere because they don't have these rigid structures for maintaining intent. I would argue maybe 3,000, certainly not more than that. Maybe 500, I don't know. I don't know quite where that crossover point is. But there is a crossover point, and that's a really interesting structure in terms of looking at how do we get away from this singular vision, because the network doesn't need to have understanding flow up to a single point. All decisions can be made at the ground level because everybody, you know, that's the point of the protocolization that goes into creating a network, is ensuring that each node in the network can make the decisions that affect itself. So, Toprocratic networks are an interesting structure. There's a Nature letter, I guess it's a letter in their term, on topocratic networks. A topocratic network, so a meritocratic network is a fully connected or close to fully connected network. And the network is performing some transactions, and because every node can talk to every other node, transactions occur on a strict efficiency basis. Now, none of this relates to like the notion of meritocracies in human society because they don't exist, but you know, in a computational meritocracy, you know, the most efficient nodes are always the ones, because everyone can reach them, they're always the ones to perform the transactions. Now, a topocratic network is a poorly connected network, and you end up deriving financial return or whatever, value return, from position in the network. And there's a trade-off that happens at some point between fully connected and partially connected networks that's related to that shift in efficacy, where those nodes that join well-connected subgraphs effectively become more powerful in the network, and you slowly shift into something more like a tree, into something more like a hierarchy. One of the really interesting things about the infrastructure that we live with these days is that it's shifting from kind of 20th century infrastructure, which was very much a thing, you know, a railroad, to, you know, that had a kind of coherent, solid scope, to, well, what is a logistics network? You know, what is a just-in-time logistics network? Well, okay, it's still railroads and warehouses and, you know, many, you know, factories and whatever. There's still this very physical material structure, but it's much more a logical structure. It's much more a piece of software that happens to run on a hardware implementation that we might call Amazon and Federal Express, you know, as like physical objects, which are, you know, themselves software. And we see this as, you know, one of the viewpoints that you can use. Who's here? Who's familiar with the word imaginary, as in an imaginary of an X? It's a really convoluted, ugly term, but it draws a certain specific thing. So the idea is, like, the imaginary of a city is people's understanding of that city, of its structure, and of the social scripts and affordances that it presents. So, you know, and that's basically, you know, among other things, it's an understanding of an infrastructure, right? So if you don't realize that the city you're in has a mass transit system, because let's say, you know, you're from a first world city and you've just spent your whole life there, and you're now in Cochabamba in Bolivia, and the mass transit system is much less legible. You know, there isn't the same uniformity of signage and whatever, and like there's very much a system there, but you don't see it. So your imaginary doesn't contain anything other than taxi cabs as a way to get around. And for you, from your perspective, that is the infrastructure that you live in, because it's the infrastructure that is legible to you. One of the things that you can do as infrastructure gets softer, or and either softer in terms of programming or in terms of humanity, you know, in terms of social scripts, is you can change the infrastructure by changing the imaginary, by telling a different story about what the infrastructure is. All of a sudden, the infrastructure becomes a different thing. Social scripts are one of the things that I think a lot about when I think about infrastructure. So one of the worlds I play in is the Nordic live-action role-playing world. How many people here? Anyone? Anyone? Yeah. So in Scandinavia, they kind of started from the same perspective of, like, let's run around in the woods and hit each other with foam swords because it's a lot of fun, in kind of the late 80s. And you know, running around in the woods and hitting each other with foam swords is still a lot of fun, and there's still a lot of people who do that, and I'm not denigrating that. But one of the really interesting shifts that happened there, because it's a much more collective society than most, is that everybody kind of started with this, well, I have a responsibility for the fun that someone else is having, and they have responsibility for the fun that I'm having, instead of just, I have responsibility for my fun. And this first expressed itself in terms of props. You know, you got to the point where it's like, well, this is a serious fantasy game. It's really not okay for you to have shown up with machine sewn underwear on. Someone might see that and you might ruin their game. You know, you need to have hand sewn underwear, kind of ridiculous in some ways. But where that shifted then was a certain, well, what if we took the stories seriously instead of just the props? And I can tell stories about interesting games and whatever for hours, but one of the really interesting games was looking at kind of an Ursula Le Guin themed fiction that really challenged a bunch of people's gender presentations and various other things, and did a bunch of really interesting things. But the most interesting outcome of that was four or five friends of mine having prototyped in this game, like unintentionally, but having effectively prototyped how a group of four or five people lives in a very small space, got a one-bedroom apartment together and lived there for 3 or 4 years in, I think, 20 meters. So, you know, a bunch of people in this very tiny space, and not as like an imposition, but just because they'd figured out how to re-script their social interaction so they didn't need the space. Now, this is really interesting, and that's rewriting what does housing mean, just with a different story. You know, and this isn't the flop, you know, the bunkhouse where you know, a bunch of folks who haven't been able to find, you know, well-paying jobs or kind of crammed in or whatever, and everybody sort of resents their presence there. It's actually just rewriting the story of what does it mean to live in a place. Scripting is interesting in general, because in that same way that you can talk about LARP or whatever, you know, other forms of rewriting social scripts as a tool for social prototyping or social reconstruction, you know, we also have scripting in the computer sense, which is kind of like, well, I mean, you know, yes, Python, whatever, people write real applications in it, it's become a real programming language. But in that core, it's basically, I'm going to take a bunch of chunks and I'm going to just sort of throw them together in this kind of transient way. And that's one of the ways where we start seeing kind of heavy infrastructure starting to shift a little bit and becoming lighter weight. Now, there's, you know, obviously you have to have access, there's various kind of privilegings that are associated with this, but it lets you start reshaping the world. One of the, I guess, political constructs I talk about in a very kind of ambivalent way is the revolution of the toolmaker, which is basically the notion that because so much of our society now is dependent on infrastructure that can be recombined in very lightweight ways that have increasingly deep impact into the way we live and the relations that we can form with each other, that toolmaker position is a privileged position that lets us rewrite society on the fly. And that's one of the things I spend a certain amount of time trying to convince hackers of, is like, no, everything you do is political. You know, there is no non-political code. There's a a really interesting pair of graphs. One of them, so if you look at Skype adoption, where do I have? So, you know, time, that's like, you know, and it's basically this, you know, really, this, you know, kind of really just, you know, geographic or geometric curve. And then, so you look at foreign aid remittances, and they're something like, they're pretty steady, they go down a little bit. And then you look at foreign aid, and then you look at remittances.
That's a remittance.
So remittances are people sending money home. And so in somewhere around kind of the mid-90s, remittances were like, I don't know, like foreign aid was like six times of what remittances are. And then almost parallel in that Skype adoption curve, they're now 8.5 times foreign aid.
What do you go, Skype? What is that?
Skype.
Okay, so the relation between Skype and
foreign aid remittances.
Right.
And, you know, this is one of these places where, you know, When people wrote Skype, they were not trying to change the structure of international monetary flows and the like sovereign power relationships between states, because most of that foreign aid is really, that's foreign policy by other means, and often war by other means. Skype was not planning on getting anywhere near that, but of course they radically changed that power balance. The law, the name of which I should remember, technology is neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral. You know, that every technology, every piece of technology shifts the possibility space, not necessarily in a positive or negative way, it just changes, it just weirds. Kelleher Easterling, who here has read Extra Statecraft?
Also in the life.
Yeah, so Extra Statecraft is a really flawed book in some ways, it's a really interesting book in other ways. I don't like this word, but I don't have a better one. She introduces the word disposition. So the disposition of a system is kind of the possibility space from the current moment forward, or possibly backwards, if you can move backwards in time. But it's talking about the potentialities of how a system may evolve or move or work. And so for the chess has a specific disposition. And a given chessboard also has a disposition in terms of what it may become. And you know there are you know there are rules, there are things that you can do, there are things that you can't do, there's meaning, and so we can, as we talk about the disposition of technologies, you know, that's kind of how they can evolve, how they can shift, how they can interact with society. One of the things we talk about in the LARP world and play theory is that the rules create the game, right? That rules are a thing that create the possibility of action. There's this notion of a magic circle from Goffman that, you know, you walk into the magic circle and now you're somewhere with different rules and a different sociality. You know, if you punch someone in a boxing ring, that's good. If you punch someone right next to a boxing ring, that's not good. You know, there's a very clear line that you've stepped over. If you don't punch someone in a boxing ring, you are breaking the rules. And, you know, but the structuring of rules creates that interactive space. If there are no rules, and they don't have to be formal, they don't have to be explicit or mechanical, but affordances for interaction, social scripts come from creating a space that has a disposition. And that's true of technical systems too. As I said yesterday, I spent a lot of time thinking about failure, because in a lot of these things, the failure is where we learn how the system actually worked. When you see a system, all happy families are the same, every unhappy family is unhappy in a different way. If all you have is well-functioning systems, you don't actually understand how the system works. You know, you kind of need to have a vague notion of how it works. But often I used to do a ton of manual code review, and we wouldn't necessarily even know quite what the system was supposed to do. That's not really required to understand how it breaks. But it will eventually expose all of the ways in which it can break. This crossover again, that's in some ways that's a failure is a complex word. It's a shift. It's a shift in meaning. You know, the thing that is bringing this line down is a structure of failure. It's a structure of failure for intent to cohere across an increasingly large structure. Failures have a disposition. This is something that I don't have good language for yet, because it's kind of abstract in this way that you stare at enough systems for long enough and you start seeing these things in your head. I guess I talk about aesthetics for a lot of these things, that every system, that I guess first of all, that there is an aesthetic frame that lets you evaluate systems, and that as you understand that aesthetic frame, you can bring kind of all of the other ways to evaluate a system under that frame. So I think of like ethics as a proper subset of aesthetics. And one of the things that it lets you do is it lets you make commensurable judgments across incommensurable categories like efficacy and ethics. If you understand them, that they're both part of this, they both shape the disposition of the system, and that disposition has an aesthetics. It's a way of using something that we are very good at making judgments on. Aesthetic judgments come fairly easily to a lot of people. We have a lot of hardware in our head that's developed culturally to make those judgments. And so it's a way of starting to see these things together. But failures aren't the only way these things break. And I guess a lot of the work that I do these days is looking at how things like these systems of superempowered seeing, these systems of state control, these systems of corporate control, these systems of force and violence projection, how they fracture, and kind of where the spaces of slippage are. And because all real security work in the end is tactical, taken from a specific lived position, and you're sort of reacting to the structures in place and the slippages in place and finding some way to navigate between them. And this is, I'll come back to the probabilistic structure now a little bit. This is where, like, if you look at like the way, what Google security team does a lot of the time now, they have a bunch of guys whose job it is to trace down malware. And the way they find malware, because of course Google sees everything, you know, they see all of them, not every person's email, not whatever, but in that sense of like everything that is kind of happening on the internet in a meaningful sense, Google can become aware of should they choose to put sensors for it into their peripheral nervous system. And so a lot of what they do is they look at, well, what's weird? How are entities behaving that are odd? And that's how they notice just a vast amount of malware. And so it's this very much statistical view of the world where what is malicious starts by being different. But even that is still, it's still this very much a tactical perspective on security. It's, you know, you are looking at a flow and you learn to see things in the flow, and from a certain standpoint, you learn what difference means, and then you react to the slippages and the fissures that difference opens up. And that can be, you know, someone, you know, in Guatemala choosing to speak in code instead of installing encrypted messaging systems because their adversary is the DEA, and they know that if they start doing this stuff, they'll just get raided. But the code is much harder for the vision that they are being exposed to of a state to interact with. It's as much that perspective as it is the kind of Google looking at the entire universe perspective.
It's also how the video surveillance system used in the city of Boston in the US works, where all kinds of different age technologies, from black and white CCTV cameras to neural cameras, are fed into one learning data system that looks for patterns. And if suddenly there's a car driving around a building, parking there, a person walking out, and that hasn't happened before, that's like, this is an anomaly, this doesn't normally happen. So if another, like, other things happen in that neighborhood, those two things will be sent to humans. It's like, take a look at this. This doesn't normally happen.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess, like, there's no, from that perspective, there's never any fixed terrain because you've got, you know, your adversaries are smart too. You know, and security world is very much, you never underestimate your adversary. Assume that they are as smart, at least as smart as you are, and probably better funded. You know, but that kind of continual shifting terrain is very much kind of like, if we're going to make it through this, it's very much kind of surfing on that shifting terrain, and how do we end up changing the stories that we use to tell ourselves about how the world works and who we are and what we're trying to do, and somehow maybe we come out human still. And that's kind of the best case scenario. But, so I guess I did just end up blathering, but hopefully that was interesting. Yeah, it comes from the UK. It's kind of Dougald Hine, who's now creative and audience engagement director at the Swedish National Theatre, which means exactly the opposite of kind of what that normally means there. But and a poet, Paul Kingsnorth, kind of the core of it. And there's a lot that I really dislike about it. It's this very kind of pastoral romantic understanding of what it means to survive and myth and all these things. And it's the problem that it points at is really fascinating, and the way it goes from there becomes less fascinating. But that their manifesto is still kind of, I think, a really useful and important starting point for one understanding of the world and one set of work. It depends on the game. It depends on kind of what the, you know, it's you know, is art a political tool?
Yes.
Sometimes. You know, some art is intended to have, you know, okay, all art has a political meaning and a political context and frame. Some art is intended to have a political meaning and context and frame or do political work. You know, and I think the LARP stuff is very much, it's a broad enough umbrella that a lot of the things that it encompasses are, can be and are politically instrumentalized, but a lot of it's, you know, kind of as much of it isn't. You know, and this is even in within this kind of, it's basically the art house scene in Scandinavia. There's a larger LARP community that's still mostly just hitting each other with foam swords and having fun, which is fine. But yeah, within that scene, I'd say it's probably at least half of all games have a pretty solid, like, political intent or political standpoint that they're coming from, even if it's not intended to instrumentalize and shift people's politics. They're starting from a, like, you know, this is who we are and how we understand the political world.
It's a lot about territory, you know?
I would say that it's much more about social performance and social scripts. Yeah, because this is, you know, so like, an example of a game there is Ground Zero, which was played in 97 in Turku for the first time, where they had a basement done up as a bomb shelter. And it was set in Topeka, Kansas in 1962. And at the start, you know, people like had dinner parties in character to sort of understand how their families interacted. And then at the start of the game, they all trooped down into this basement and the game started and they're listening to historical radio broadcasts from the Cuban Missile Crisis. And, you know, the situation outside gets worse and worse, and then at a certain point it cuts into a fictionalized version. And in this fiction, the second U2 also gets shot down, and then at a certain point the radio cuts out, and then the power dies and they light candles, and then the kind of the one, the big scenery is there, these boxes of, like, you know, canned food, you know, cardboard boxes lining the walls. And then at a certain point, there's this massive earth-shattering boom because there's actually a bunch of subwoofers hidden in there. And then they sit in the dark for the next 22 hours and come to terms with the fact that the city that they lived in is erased, that there's nothing to go back to, and sort of dealing with the psychological fallout of what that means. And then at the end of the game the next morning, the organizers basically pull open the door and, you know, daylight streams in and they say, okay, so the shelter cracked and radioactive water leaked in and a third of you died of cancer. We're not saying who. And this leaves this really powerful political impact. And this was definitely a game which had a very specific political intent to explore, but it's exploring in the affective frame, you know, and in the interaction frame. You know, what does this thing mean emotionally? And that's one of the things, like, we have a lot of great simulation and prototyping tools for functionality, for, you know, how does the thing work, but we don't have very many for how does the thing feel. And that's kind of why I've ended up dragging a bunch of this stuff into it, otherwise kind of much more hard practice.
It's also about these kind of multiple layers, because I mean, the one thing I remember from college, I didn't really take part in the gaming community, but it was very present. And the thing I remember was the sort of pleasure of the way people would wear this badge that said, I'm not here.
Yeah.
Which was a signal to say, like, that was the convention of how you're playing the game, but at times you step out of the game,
yeah.
And you have to indicate that I'm not in the game at the moment. But so there was this whole pleasure of the fact that people could be in reality, but in the game, also in reality and out of the game. And so, yeah, there's something as well about it. It's not so much, it's kind of territory, but it's a play with, I mean, that's what I kind of hear.
Yeah.
It's about actually that kind of pleasure of exploring possibilities.
Yeah. Once you learn that you can rewrite social rules, everything suddenly looks rewritable. It's like, well, why don't we just rewrite this?
Yeah.
You know.
There's a kind of interesting tension of legal positivism of all things.
Yeah.
Because the defined nature of art, which is basically that the aim of legal positivism is to do well.
But it's just an interesting tension.
Yeah.
A direct correspondent. But Hart was interested in doing away with morality and the religious basis of law. And so Leachbold's based on the idea there's a basic set of rules that define what law can be, and anything that fulfills those rules becomes law.
Yeah.
But where it's wrapped up in this whole institutional state-related framework that aims towards objectivity, but you can see a tension with LARP, and it has a similar constructiveness to it. But disputes the whole idea of objectivity that legal positivism.
Yeah, this is very much a purely subjective, but in the feminist sense of, like, all experience is subjective. Sort of, you know, we're creating a thing that we have an emotional reaction to, and the emotional reaction is what makes it interesting and valid.
Yeah, and in a way both deal with possible worlds as well.
Yeah.
But in a way that legal positivism is normative.
Yeah.
It seeks to normalize a particular vision of what a possible world would be, whereas LARP acts as a kind of critical tool upon that.
Yeah.
As an ancient kind of critical practice upon the idea of the state and legally defined consequences.
Yeah, there's a book, Legal Traditions of the World, which I read when I was doing a bunch of governance work, which kind of talks about seven different legal systems that have existed at various times. Civil and common and Judaic and Sharia and some of the various Islamic law systems, and probably a couple other that I'm missing. But one of the things it talks about, there's an entire chapter on tradition. It's like tradition being kind of the root of law and what it means to, you know, basically, like, the reason why, you know, if you go to a church and you go take mass, you're not laughing is because there's a tradition of moral behavior that has a pastness associated with it, and there's this weight of history that makes things seem normal and sensible. And one of the things which is really interesting about LARP is that it lets us ascribe pastness to things that we want to try out, and, like, what would we do if this was normal? How would it feel if this was normal? And you can just kind of pastness as a thing that, well, as soon as you step into that magic circle, you can just pour pastness on, and all of a sudden, whatever the rules are, both of, you know, that's how society works. And then you find out, in this kind of tension between who you are as a player and who you are as a character in your different experiences, by association is kind of one of the roots of creativity, working from two separate systems. And this lets us live two lives in parallel and see what emerges in the contrast between those lives. And that's a lot of the skill of LARP writing. A large part of the skill of LARP writing is figuring out what kinds of bi-associative experiences are going to be interesting for a group of people and are going to teach them new things or take them places where they want to explore.
Curious a little bit about this complexity of rewriting social scripts. You mentioned these five friends who decided to live differently. How does that happen in practice? Like, how did it happen for that particular case? Did they came up with a script and then they tested it and then went back to, or was it after the experience, or?
They had this experience not intending to do this thing. They had this experience that created for them a new affordance. It created an affordance of a small room of being a potential living space. And because they had been through this experience where the scripts that created that affordance had been ascribed pastness because they lived them both physically for a short while, but also kind of narratively for a longer time, it kind of showed them that possibility. And then so this, they were living in Stockholm, and Stockholm was and is still a fairly expensive real estate market.
But how did they switch from experience into abstraction of making it a knowledge or like a script that could be shared?
So I guess this is, I guess two things. One, this is the skill of playing is, and the skill of playing in this context is doing that shift between concrete experience, possibly through a character, but still a concrete experience, and an understanding and a reading of social scripts that created that experience, and kind of going back and forth. And that's probably, a friend Eric did a talk on, I don't know if Nordic LARP matters, but Nordic LARP design does matter. And that's the skill that he's pointing at, is that shift between, that ability to jump between concrete experience and social script, and then kind of revising social script or experiencing a new experience, and kind of back and forth. So to a certain extent, it's just a thing that having done that, you get used to doing. I think to another degree, though, it worked for them. It's not, social scripts are not things that you rarely learn them as abstract knowledge. You learn a new social script by doing the thing and like being, whether it's like a really formal induction as like, at first day at university, there's this whole process that teaches you how to be a student and how to perform that set of social scripts. Or it's, you go over to a Jewish friend's house for, I've lost my word. Yeah, for Passover, and you learn, oh, there's a ritual here, and you're kind of taught it, but you're not taught it. Well, maybe you're taught it explicitly, but you're kind of showing it as you do it. And and as you go, you learn that social script or...
Well, say different ways of greeting people in different countries.
Yeah. You do it the first few times and it's sort of awkward and then you just get used to it. And then you kind of absorb
because
that.
Because it's so experiential.
Yeah.
I find that using the term script is kind of counter... intuitive, if you want to describe this
so
situation.
The reason why I talk about, partially I talk about them as scripts because there's a whole kind of field of social psychology which talks about that as a thing. But it also, a script is something that we all understand that we can write and change.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it clear that there is a legible object there that we can interact with, and that it has a bunch of different design surfaces that we can change. But, of course it is, in the end, completely experiential. This is the wave particle duality of what it means to have a society. you know, you can see it both as a collection of legible, semi-formal social scripts and as just a bunch of lived experience. And the two, you know, which, what do you need to see in the moment? Do you need to see particles or do you need to see waves? You know, what behavior is the experiment or the system that you're using? You know, what does it need? What does it expect?
But getting these sometimes the shift, because you were talking a lot about intention, the shift from intention to desire.
Desire. I'm just, because of the social script of food. Can we move this discussion to the table? Because not just to, because the food is ready and my stomach.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think it's
very
important.
Turning attention to desire.